control your bubbling and boiling emotions. You shut them off, or at least you think you do. The reality is that you build a wall around them. Your fear and anxiety still bubbles and boils, but now they are walled in. You cannot shut down just the bad emotions, so you try to shut them all down. That means you no longer experience joy or happiness, because you have become Mr. Control Freak when it comes to your feelings. Maybe the only way you can have a good time is when you're drunk. If that is the case, you have a serious problem. With your emotions walled in, you feel detached and even estranged from others. Although you have loving feelings for your family and close friends, you cannot communicate them. You are unable to say the L word, because it cannot climb over that high wall. Consider this case study. Early in the morning, two other officers and I were talking in a parking lot, when one of the officers, Howard, said he was going to check a car on a nearby street. He was a veteran officer of 13 years who had just transferred from narcotics to patrol. I didn't think much of him going to check a car, assuming it was unoccupied, so I didn't go with him. About 10 minutes later, I received a call of gunshots in an area about a mile from my location. At first, I didn't think anything of it, since those calls come in all the time, often only backfires. Howard was dispatched as my follow unit, but he didn't answer the call. Seconds later, I was told by dispatch that a citizen was calling and saying that he heard gunshots in front of his house, and there was a police unit out front with its overhead lights on. As I tore away from the parking lot and was rolling code 3 to get there, one of the most chilling things I've ever heard came over the radio. A citizen's voice telling us that an officer had been shot and was down in the street. As I turned onto the street, I saw Howard on the ground in front of his unit, with a small crowd of citizens nearby. I tried to comfort him, but I was unsure what to do for him. He had wounds to his face and below his vest and back. He gave me a description of the shooter as the paramedics arrived. I helped load him into the ambulance, rode with him to the hospital, and was with him in the operating room. When they wheeled him out, I thought he was going to be okay. But when I went into the recovery room, I was told he was dead. I broke down and cried as I stood there in operating scrubs. Detectives ushered me out before they brought in his wife. I was driven back to the police department, still wearing the scrubs, which I objected to. I wanted to walk in the same way I walked out, as a police officer in uniform, not a crying lump in scrubs, with all my peers looking. They called in our department psychologist, who I had not seen since he made the decision whether I was to be hired as a police officer. In my mind, I thought if I showed weakness, they would fire me. So I said I was okay and essentially refused to talk to him. Over the next few months, I changed drastically. My work performance came almost to a halt, as I spent most of my time drinking coffee and bullshitting. I was short-tempered and moody, and I began to slowly withdraw from my wife. Then I decided I didn't love her anymore and wanted a divorce. I drank heavily and experienced flashbacks to the night of the shooting. Once, I drove by the scene of Howard's shooting, and I saw a police unit with its lights on in the same position as Howard's had been. But when I turned down the street, it was dark and empty. Several times, I saw Howard sitting in the briefing room, and I also passed him driving another police car. I went to see the psychiatrist again, and he did help me a little, though I wasn't completely upfront with him. A while later, I moved out from my wife and in with a single officer. I drank and chased women and drove myself in debt. Several times, as I sat alone in my room, I put my gun barrel against my head. I'm still amazed I didn't pull the trigger. After a few months of this, I realized I was killing myself. My wife, wonderful woman that she is, held on through all of this and kept in touch through mutual friends, since I rarely returned her calls. I called her one day and told her I would go to marriage counseling with her. We eventually got back together. Today, I take my job much less seriously. I still do it to the best of my ability and take survival seriously, but the job no longer consumes my life. My wife and I have a 10-month-old son now who I love. It scares me to think how close I came to losing my wife and never knowing my son. Officer Jim Holder, correspondence to Colonel Grossman. Persistent symptoms of arousal. Heat not a furnace for your foe so hot that it do singe yourself. Shakespeare, King Henry VIII. Now look at paragraph D in our DSM extract. You might begin to have persistent symptoms of increased arousal and difficulty falling or staying asleep. Since your wall prevents you from dealing with the memory of the event during the day, it haunts you in your dreams. Of course, it is normal to have nightmares about the event, but in time they should go away. However, if you do not make peace with the memories during the day, they will come back in your dreams and those horrific images will disrupt your sleep for months, even years after. You might become increasingly irritable and have outbursts of anger. Now, a normal, healthy person deals with his anger every day. Hey, that bothered me. Please don't do that again. Expressing your feelings about something is a healthy response, but your emotions are walled in, so you cannot express them. Each day, you get a little angrier until you explode in an outburst of rage, and everyone wonders where it came from. The outburst might even surprise you, too, since you thought you no longer had emotions. Well, they were there all along. You were just deceiving yourself by holding them in. My co-author tells of a fellow officer who was forced to kill two people in two separate incidents. In the last one, he shot and killed a teenager in a lawful self-defense situation, or, in police vernacular, a righteous shoot. 2 years later, when Christensen asked the officer if he could interview this individual for his book, Deadly Force Encounters, the officer refused, saying that he was still having trouble coming to terms with his last shooting. Other than that statement, there were no other outward indicators that he was having problems, until a few months later. As was his usual, the officer walked into the precinct and then into the locker room. Then, seemingly from out of nowhere, he exploded into a tremendous rage, screaming, punching lockers, and throwing benches about. When a sergeant approached him, the officer threatened him with deadly force. The man was quickly relieved of duty and subsequently placed on disability. You might also have difficulty concentrating because your mind is so busy trying to not think about this painful memory. This might cause a state of constant hypervigilance and an exaggerated startle response. Yes, a warrior should be vigilant and alert, and he should be the one who sits with his back to the wall. But this extreme vigilance and exaggerated startle response are aspects that did not exist before the traumatic event. This unabated tension, which begins as a psychological issue, can cause long-term physical health problems as your endocrine system pours out a steady stream of hormones and other chemicals attacking the body over a period of years. To combat this over-arousal, you might self-medicate with alcohol, cannabis, or tranquilizers. That, of course, is not the solution, and will only lead to new problems. It is quite normal to experience some of these symptoms after a traumatic incident. Consider it a normal reaction to an abnormal event in your life. Should one or more of these last only a few days, it is not PTSD. But when they last longer than a month and cause clinically significant distress or impairment in your life, you just might have post-traumatic stress disorder. Our Father's Pain. When I got home from the war and someone would ask if I had killed anyone, I asked them why they wanted to know. Did it make me more macho or scary or loathsome? Did you want all the details? Or did you just want to see me shake like a leaf? Tell me what's in your head and I'll tell you what's in mine. If it's just morbid curiosity, go away. I don't need this and you don't either. I'm not ashamed of what I did in Vietnam, but I don't need to brag about it. Tom Hain, Vietnam veteran. Many of us have fathers who are veterans of World War II, Korea, or Vietnam. When these warriors came home and experienced many of the manifestations discussed here, most of them did not have PTSD. They were able to live fully functional lives with their social and occupational areas under control. Still, they might have had a restricted range of affect, since they held much inside. Michael Pritchard, an ex-cop, a great professional speaker and comedian, says this about these men. You want to see a World War II vet let it all hang out? Here it is. Nothing happens. You want to see it again? His point is that these vets never let it all hang out. Instead, they hold it all in. That is not necessarily healthy, but it is not necessarily PTSD. It is just how they manifested their experience in the war. While some people do suffer from full-blown PTSD, most cases are mild. What often occurs is that a doctor tells a patient that his symptoms look like PTSD, and that diagnosis impacts that person right between the eyes, as if he were told he had cancer. Well, it is not like cancer. It is more like being overweight. If you weigh 30 pounds more than you should, those extra pounds, while tiring to lug around, are probably not life-threatening. To get rid of the poundage, you just do a little dieting and you're fine. On the other hand, should you be 400 pounds overweight, your life is greatly impacted. In fact, it just might kill you tomorrow. Most cases of PTSD are like carrying 30 pounds of extra weight around. It is extra work, but you can live with it. And if you make the effort to rid yourself of the PTSD, you are going to be fine. To reiterate, some people do suffer from full-blown PTSD, but it is comparatively rare. There are also other people who have all of the manifestations, but they are mild. It is important that you bring the issue into perspective and think of it more along the lines of being overweight than being stricken with cancer and all that that means. Put it in perspective and make peace with the memory. No macho man and no pity party. Based on my work with many combat and post-deployment veterans, in order for a person to feel normal while still suffering the sequels of trauma, he must be able to view the symptoms as a normal reaction to an external threat rather than an illness. Dr. Jacques J. Gauss, Combat Stress Inoculation, PTSD Recognition, and Early Intervention. One danger in studying PTSD is that we might be tempted to identify all the ways that things did not go perfectly, and then use that as an excuse to have a sulking pity party. However bad it was for us in combat, we must understand that our reactions are normal. Try to keep your combat experiences in perspective. If you feel like you received no support from your community or your chain of command, then consider the plight of the Vietnam veterans. Though they were spit on and condemned upon their return from a year in combat, most of them dealt with it and have gone on to make great contributions to our nation. How America abused and mistreated our Vietnam veterans is covered in much greater detail in my book, On Killing. Many Vietnam veterans were truly harmed by this process, but this needs to be put into perspective. B.G. Burkett's book, Stolen Valor, is an extremely valuable resource to help us understand that, in spite of what we did to them, the Vietnam veterans have done very well. The stereotype of the emotionally marred, psychologically destroyed Vietnam vet is, in most cases, a myth. This is not to belittle anyone's experiences, or to say that your pain is not as bad as someone else's. The goal here is to recognize that the warriors of these past great battles did not have critical incident debriefings and all the other progressive techniques we have now, and most of them were just fine. Likewise, most of today's warriors will be fine. We just need to be sure that our study of psychiatric illness in combat does not turn us into psychological hypochondriacs or psychochondriacs. Although most veterans of World War I and World War II were okay, our goal today is to do things better. For example, they did not have antibiotics in World War I, and most of them were okay in spite of that. But that doesn't mean that we want to go into combat without antibiotics available to our doctors. Each passing year and each generation, step by step, we learn to do a better job. Across the years, there has developed an appropriate warrior ethic of not complaining. Our forefathers who fought in two world wars, Korea and Vietnam, returned with a group ethic of closed-mouthed pride. The son of one veteran put it this way. My father survived the Bataan Death March, escaped, was recaptured, and spent 3.5 years as a Japanese POW. He never spoke of the war that made a sad man of him. The very pride that helped him survive also made him unable to seek help. He died many years later from damage done by bayonet wounds and beatings he endured. Some have said he never really came back from the war. A suck-it-up-and-drive-on ethos has great survival value in the heat of battle, but it has also kept us from seeking helpful treatment after the battle. One veteran police officer who survived a shooting experience told me, "Colonel, you tell all these young guys, don't try to be a macho man. Tell them to get help if they need it. I tried to macho it out after my shooting and didn't get help when I needed it, and it damn near killed me. No sane person would turn down antibiotics if the doctor prescribed them, and no reasonable warrior should turn away from psychological help if it is available and needed. Toti Karpela, the head instructor of the Helsinki, Finland Police Department, says it well. It is a sign of strength to admit that you're not always strong enough. The presence of new tactics and new medicines saves lives in modern combat, but lives are still lost. Doing a better job in the area of psychological debriefings and bulletproofing the mind will reduce psychiatric casualties, but it is no guarantee. Do you see how we can walk that middle road between the mindless macho man on one side and the pity party on the other? The bulletproof vest does not stop everything. It is not a guarantee. Likewise, the bulletproof mind is not failsafe, but we are far better off with it than without it. As Dr. Jonathan Shea, author of the superb book Achilles in Vietnam, says, in my own preaching on prevention of psychological and moral injury, I emphasize that we are talking about flak jackets, helmets, and well-made and well-sighted fighting positions, not godlike invulnerability. No macho man and no pity party. We must walk that middle road, applying the best tools we can while not permitting ourselves to sink into self-pity when things are not perfect. But in this age of sensational tabloid journalism, the media can encourage our returning warriors to wallow in the pity party by presenting endless reports and exaggerated news pieces implying that virtually every veteran of the war is suffering from full-blown PTSD. This can create dire consequences, as we shall see in a moment. Here is a letter that I often send the press in response to their queries about the military and PTSD. It's taken in part from an article of mine that appeared in Greater Good magazine. Today, I am on the road almost 300 days a year, speaking to police agencies and numerous military organizations, deploying and returning from combat. I teach them that there are two dangers they must guard against. One is that of the macho man mentality that can cause a soldier to refuse to accept vital mental health services. The other danger is what I call the pity party. Interestingly, the very awareness of the possibility of PTSD can increase the probability that it will occur. There is a tendency for human beings to respond to stress in the way that they think they should. When soldiers, their spouses, parents, and others are convinced that the returning veteran will suffer from PTSD, it can create a powerful self-fulfilling prophecy. I decline most requests for media interviews because of my time-intensive traveling and teaching schedule. I also decline them because I refuse to be part of that drumbeat of voices that tells veterans that they are doomed to a lifetime of psychological trauma. I tell the media the truth, but then they edit out anything that does not support their belief that the war will destroy all the soldiers and will pay a price for generations to come. This sensationalist, if it bleeds, it leads journalism, is irresponsible because it can cause more harm to our veterans. Sadly, it is not difficult to find people in the mental health community to support the thesis that anyone who kills, experiences combat, or witnesses violence, or any other fill-in-the-blank victim du jour, is doomed to lifetime PTSD and, consequently, needs lifelong mental health care. Too few mental health professionals communicate to their patients that, one, they can recover quickly from PTSD, and that, two, you will become stronger from the experience. Yet that expectation must be there if there is to be any hope of anything other than a lifetime of expensive counseling. One National Public Radio piece in 2012 said that over 100 veterans have come home and committed murder. Think about that for a minute. We've had over 2 million Americans in the war zone. The Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics tells us that the homicide rate for Americans between ages 18 and 25 is around 25 per 100,000. So, out of any million Americans in that age group, there should be around 250 murders per year. Out of 2 million, there should have been 500 murders. Extrapolate that data back across 10 years of war, And there should have been, statistically speaking, thousands of murders by this population group. All they proved is that the murder rate for our vets is less than a tenth of that for other citizens of the same age, which is pretty much in keeping with the stats from our past wars. Here is what I tell all my military and law enforcement audiences. PTSD is not like pregnancy. You cannot be a little bit pregnant. Either you are or you're not. PTSD is not like that. PTSD is like being overweight. Many people carry around 10, 20, or 30 pounds of excess weight. Although it influences the individual every minute of every day, it might not be a big deal health-wise. But for those people who are 500 pounds overweight, it will likely kill them any day now. There was a time when we could only identify people who had 500 pounds of PTSD. Today, we are better at spotting folks who carry lesser loads, 30, 40, or 50 pounds of PTSD. I have read statistics that say 15% of our military is coming home with some manifestation of psychological problems. Others claim it is 20%, and still others report 30%. Well, depending on how you want to measure it, 30% of all college freshmen have some manifestation of psychological problems. Mostly what is being reported on today are people with low levels of PTSD, 30, 40, or 50 pounds of PTSD, who in previous wars would not have been detected. We are getting damn good at identifying and treating PTSD, and when the treatment is done, most people are better for the experience. PTSD is not like frostbite. Frostbite causes permanent damage to your body. If you get frostbite, for the rest of your life, you will be more vulnerable to it. PTSD is not like that. PTSD can be more like the flu. The flu can seriously kick your tail for a while. But once you shake it off, you probably are not going to get it again for the rest of the year. You have been inoculated. PTSD can kick your tail for a while, months and even years. But once you have dealt with it, next time it will take a lot more to knock you off your feet because you have been stress inoculated. When I was a kid, World War II veterans were everywhere. They were our police sergeants, captains, and chiefs. They were our battalion commanders and our senior NCOs. They were our business leaders and our political leaders. The idea that a World War II veteran was a shallow, fragile creature who would break under pressure was ridiculous. There were some people like that. Everyone knew of a few, but they were rare. Nietzsche said, "That which does not kill me makes me stronger." By the way, that is the title of a book that I commend to your attention. What Does Not Kill Me: The New Science of Post-Traumatic Growth. The Bible says something similar many times. For example, Romans chapter 5 says, "We glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation worketh patience, and patience experience, and experience hope, and hope maketh not ashamed." Throughout history, we have understood that bad things can make us stronger. The World War II generation was the greatest generation, and today a new greatest generation is coming home. That is, if we do not screw them all up by telling them and their families, their neighbors, and their employers that they are ticking time bombs doomed to a lifetime of mental illness. Here is what I believe is the heart of the matter. To harm and destroy people, you have to lie. Lie number one, ignore the vast majority who are just fine and report only on the minority with problems. Lie number two, fail to report that most PTSD cases are people with only 30, 40, or 50 pounds of PTSD, people who in previous wars would have gone undetected. Lie number three, fail to report that we are damn good at treating PTSD and that we are getting better at it every day. Lie number four, fail to report that PTSD can be a step on the path to stress inoculation and that you can be stronger when you come out the other end. Lie four times over. Lie the worst kind of lie, the lie of omission that gives only the distilled essence of the bad news. Create an expectation in veterans and their families, employers, and neighbors that they are all fragile creatures who will snap at any time and are doomed to a life of suffering. Get veterans invested in their grievance and in their role as victim. Get them to draw disability from PTSD and convince them that they will never recover. I want the media to care, but I am convinced that most of them are part of a mob mentality, a pile-on, if it bleeds, it leads profession that does not care about the harm they do. Remember, this is the same profession that put the Columbine killers on the cover of Time magazine twice. Yes, twice. Thus giving these brutal mass murderers the very fame and immortality they wanted. This, in turn, inspired people like the Virginia Tech and Sandy Hook killers, who also appeared on every news show and on the front page of every newspaper in the nation. Sadly, this, too, inspires countless others as the media continues to be their happy co-conspirators in a murder-for-fame and immortality contract. Please forgive me if I have been harsh, but the situation calls for us to be passionate. Yes, some of our veterans will suffer from PTSD, and we have an obligation to give them the best possible support. But we also need a balanced, tough love that creates an expectation that they will get over it, get on with it, and be better for the experience, that they will be the new greatest generation. I prefer to emphasize the positive expectations, positive self-fulfilling prophecies. Now, there is a nice concept, but will we ever see it in the news? EMDR, when you cannot make peace with the memory. Days of darkness still come o'er me. Sorrow's path I often tread. Francis Rowley, I will sing the wondrous story. There is a tool being used now that appears to have proven itself to be helpful in many cases of PTSD. I will just mention the treatment briefly here and suggest you research it further if you are interested. Although eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing, EMDR, treatment sounds mystical, there are studies that show an 85 to 90% success rate with it. Let me say first that it has been my experience talking with thousands upon thousands of police officers and soldiers that these warriors have the most finely tuned BS meters, nonsense gauges, in the world. If something works for this cynical, conservative, hard-nosed bunch, then it works, period. Well, it is still controversial, and there is still much to be learned. But the reports from the trenches are that EMDR works. EMDR is an innovative therapeutic treatment introduced by Dr. Francine Shapiro in 1989. Police psychologist Dr. Alexis Artwell, co-author of Deadly Force Encounters, is one of the early psychologists to use EMDR in the Northwest. She says that many others are now on board with this strange but very effective tool. In fact, there are over 50,000 practitioners worldwide using it today. It is not clear how EMDR works because neuroscience researchers are still exploring how the brain works. Research suggests that when a person is extremely upset, the brain cannot process information as it does normally. A traumatic event that sparks intense emotion becomes frozen in time in the information processing system. Then, as the person goes about his normal day, he runs into external reminders of the experience that triggers a re-experiencing of the sights, sounds, smells, thoughts, body sensations, or emotions of that event that often feel as intense as they did at the time it really happened. The EMDR-trained mental health professional follows a procedure based on the specifics of each person. First, the clinician helps the client identify an image that represents the target situation, say a shooting, and the emotions and body sensations associated with the memory. The client then works through these memories while he watches the clinician's moving hand or a moving set of lights, which causes voluntary eye movements. In some cases, auditory tones or hand taps are used instead. After each set of eye movements, tones, or taps, the client is asked to briefly comment on what he felt. While the results of the EMDR session are different for every person, most find that they get a reduction in the negative feelings they had been experiencing. Here is what we think is happening with EMDR and your personal puppy. The midbrain is a simple mechanism. It can only do one thing at a time. Now, the puppy is out in the yard chasing a ball, chasing that visual stimulus, and is so busy watching the clinician's visual stimulus that he does not charge through the hole in the screen door and pee in your lap. For the first time since the traumatic event, you are able to work your way through the memory without interference from the puppy. The result is that you begin to patch that hole in the screen door. The clinician is highly supportive during the processing of upsetting memories, emotions, and so on. Should difficulties arise, he makes clinical decisions about needed interventions to achieve the most positive outcome possible during the session. A specific traumatic memory or disturbing situation may resolve in as few as 1 to 3 sessions. It is a powerful tool that often works and can work incredibly fast. If you are having trouble with persistent re-experiencing of a traumatic event, that is, the puppy keeps coming for a visit, I encourage you to look into it. The next frontier. The last and hardest conquest of the mind. The Odyssey, Homer. Prior unresolved trauma in your life predisposes you to combat stress and PTSD. As Gavin De Becker puts it, your past is buried, but for some people, it is buried alive. When you are faced with a traumatic, frightening incident, you may revert to whatever level of unresolved residual stress you have from past experiences. In that case, De Becker says, it will be at least as bad as the worst thing you experienced before, which can be pretty bad. Techniques such as EMDR, used ahead of time to confront and defuse your ghosts, might be a tool that can negate or preempt this possibility. After we have mastered stress inoculation, incorporated the breathing exercise, understood and applied the prevention of PTSD by delinking the memory from the emotions, the next step in developing warriors and healthy human beings may be this systematic preemption of trauma before combat. I first met Dr. Per Hamid Gatan, a brilliant MD and PhD specializing in cognitive neurophysiology, when I was presenting at a conference in Stockholm, Sweden. Large groups of Gulf War veterans came home in the early 1990s and began having serious problems commonly known as Gulf War syndrome. Dr. Gatan believes that the exposure of young children to profoundly frightening movies at an early age might have interacted with a host of other stressors and toxins to predispose combat veterans to become stress casualties. As discussed earlier, we are truly abusing children by exposing them to images of horrific, brutal murders on television, movies, and video games during an age when they cannot tell the difference between fantasy and reality. Link that with De Becker's theory that your traumatic experience will be at least as bad as your worst unresolved residual fear, and we can begin to understand that Dr. Gatan may very well be right. In the Gulf War, Afghanistan, and Iraq, our warriors performed superbly. But could it be that many of them were predisposed to stress casualties due to the toxic nature of our modern culture? Perhaps. This is only a theory and must be viewed with extreme caution. But it is one more reason why we must study this realm. More than ever before, we must make sure that all the variables we can control have been manipulated so that the degree of stress and trauma our warriors encounter before, during, and after combat have been reduced as much as possible. Concern for man himself and his fate must form the chief interest for all technical endeavors. Never forget this in the midst of your diagrams and equations. Albert Einstein. Chapter 4, A Time to Heal, The Role of Critical Incident Debriefings in Preventing PTSD. To everything there is a season, and a time for every purpose under the heaven. There is a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to reap, a time to kill and a time to heal. Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Pain shared equals pain divided. Joy shared equals joy multiplied. Well, it has happened here in the city of Elgin. A man, thrown out of a bar for harassing women and arguing with employees over his bar tab, went home, shaved his head, put on camel fatigues, gathered up 2 shotguns, 2 handguns, and 220 rounds of ammo, and went back to the bar. First, he shot into a car in the parking lot, injuring 2 women, and then he walked into the bar and shot a male patron who died. He then began screaming lines from Natural Born Killers and shot an additional 20 people, including the bartender, who died. The offender was apparently first targeting people wearing purple shirts, which the employees wore, and then he began shooting randomly. The body count, 23 injured. 18 of those shot, 2 dead. One woman will lose the use of the lower portion of her arm. She took a contact hit from a shotgun when she raised her arm to defend herself. Her limb was just hanging by a shred of flesh. I was called in for a critical incident debriefing that night before the officers were released to go home. I have never seen more officers shaken up after an event that did not include an officer-involved shooting, especially the young officer first on the scene who could hear shots still being fired inside when he arrived. Correspondence to Colonel Grossman from Commander Dave Barrows. What is this critical incident debriefing that Dave Barrows conducted after this horrific incident? This is still a new, developing, evolving field. There is much to learn. In some areas, it is still considered controversial, but it is really quite simple. And in the military and law enforcement fields where lives are on the line and lessons have been learned the hard way, this concept has been embraced and widely accepted. In Deadly Force Encounters, Art Wallen Christensen tell us that a debriefing is any discussion after an event that helps the participants come to terms with it and learn from it. Hopefully, it helps to gain closure so that event will not continue to cause emotional distress. An informal debriefing can simply be a discussion that arises spontaneously after an event, while a formal debriefing takes the discussion one step further because it's organized and facilitated to ensure it helps everyone. Dr. Greg Belenke is a U.S. Army colonel and psychiatrist working at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. He is also one of the Army's leading experts and a true pioneer in PTSD treatment and critical incident debriefings. I have had the honor of being a co-presenter with Dr. Belenke at several conferences. He teaches that there are 2 primary functions of a critical incident debriefing. First, it is essential to reconstruct the event from the beginning to the end, to learn what went wrong, what was done right, and to help develop operational lessons. The Army believes that the majority of the learning on a tactical exercise comes afterwards in what is called an after-action review, where all the participants talk about what took place. This phase is so important that to not do it is to have essentially wasted the exercise. If this is true of a training event, how much more important is it to learn from what happened when blood was shed and lives were lost? Second, the debriefing is a time to put everyone back together. Remember, there might be memory loss, memory distortion, irrational guilt, and a host of other factors clouding the ability of the combatants to deal with everything that happened to them. The debriefing is a tool to sort out these matters and to restore morale and unit integrity. It can make lives healthier, and sometimes it even saves them. Another way to look at the objective of the debriefing can be found in an old expression by E.E. Doc Smith, a Ph.D. and famous science fiction author in the 1930s. Smith presented this as an equation. Pain shared equals pain divided. Joy shared equals joy multiplied. Pain shared is pain divided, and joy shared is joy multiplied. That is the essence of the human condition. Historically, we have always gathered together after a traumatic event to divide each other's pain, and to multiply our joy. We do this in wakes and in funerals, and we have always done it after battles to lift up, multiply, and amplify the valor, the sacrifice, and the professionalism of the living and the dead. There has always been time for a remembrance, a time to touch on that which was good and fine about a fallen comrade. Across the centuries, in funerals, wakes, and around the campfire, warriors would tell of their fallen comrade, the noble deeds that they had personally witnessed, the lessons in life that had been taught, and how their lives had been shaped by the life which was now departed. They also found humor in what happened, a strange, twisted, dark humor at times, simple and childlike at other times. But always they found the peace and healing of humor in what they did. And this was an important part of multiplying the joy. At the same time, they also shared and divided the suffering, the grief, and the pain, breaking it into manageable chunks, grieving intensely and briefly, so that they could bear it and get on with life. We see this a lot in funerals and wakes, where there can be a lot of tears and a lot of laughter. We conducted these debriefings every night around the campfire throughout history. You see, up until the 20th century, warriors almost always took the nights off. After Agincourt, Waterloo, Pickett's Charge, Bunker Hill, and San Juan Hill, the winners and the losers sat around their separate campfires that night and debriefed. After 10,000 battles across thousands of years, warriors have always gathered to put together the pieces and figure out what happened. Combat is a corrosive, toxic environment, but someone has to do it. Just as surely as someone has to go into blazing buildings, toxic waste sites, and hospitals full of infectious diseases, so too does someone have to go into combat to confront those who would do us harm. George Orwell said, "We sleep safely in our beds this night because rough men stand ready in the night to visit violence on those who would do us harm." Someone has to do it. So across the centuries, over thousands of years, slowly, painfully, we found a way to be able to live with ourselves after combat and then go back into the heart of darkness again and again. In my science fiction book, The Two Space War, there is a young private who has had all the bad experiences of most green recruits in combat. At the end of the book, he tells his captain, "The part that bothers me is the lies. It's all a lie. The poetry and the glory and the honor, it's a lie. I've seen war, and it's not like that." The captain replies, "No, my friend, it's not a lie. It's men making the best of a dirty, nasty job that has to be done. There are times when evil comes, when darkness falls, and good men must fight. Then we make a virtue of necessity. Pain shared is pain divided. Joy shared is joy multiplied." Every night around the campfire, or with our messmates over dinner, we talk about the battle. Each time we divide our pain and we multiply our joy, until in the end, we've turned combat into something we can live with, something we can keep on doing. It would be a lie if we completely forgot the pain, the suffering, and the loss. But it's not a lie to recognize that there is good to be found in battle. And it's not a lie to focus on the good parts, to magnify the joy and divide the pain so that we can live with it. There is glory if we give it to them. There is honor if we honor those who do it. Sometimes wars have to be fought. It destroys enough. It harms enough during the war. It is foolishness. It is madness to let it destroy us after the war. So we turn it into something we can live with, and we turn ourselves into creatures who can do this dirty, desperate job, do it well, and live with it afterwards. In Henry V, Shakespeare wrote, "There is some soul of goodness in things evil, and men should observingly distill it out." War is a great evil, but upon occasion it may be a necessary evil. Perhaps we should not judge those who must partake of that evil and attempt to distill some goodness out of it. Warriors weep at funerals. According to reports, in one 10-minute period on Omaha Beach, a single rifle company of 205 men lost 197, including every officer and sergeant. These were not pointless or avoidable deaths. The price was very high, but for that which they died was sacred. We remember. Their comrades in arms remember. And those who could came back. William J. Bennett, from a lecture at the United States Naval Academy. Across countless thousands of years, men have developed two rules of behavior after combat. These rules are not mindless macho nonsense. They are valuable tools that have evolved at great cost. The first rule is that it is okay to weep at the funeral of a beloved comrade or family member. We mourn briefly, intensely, and unashamedly, and then we get on with life. Lord Wavell, the Supreme Commander of the British Forces in World War II, wrote in his book, Other Men's Flowers, that heavy mourning, deep black edges, long widowhood, unrestrained grief are out of fashion, as they should be to a generation which is indulged in war. Sir Henry Taylor put it this way, "He that lacks time to mourn, lacks time to mend. Eternity mourns that. 'Tis an ill cure for life's worst ills, to have no time to feel them." After the battle, we must find time to mourn. There is no shame in it. We need it. Our long-term survival demands it, and the dead have earned our tears. You have the right to mourn any way you choose. Strength and even denial are forms of mourning. But you should know that most warrior societies across the ages have found it appropriate and healthy to shed tears for their fallen comrades. Whatever you do, don't blot their memory out. Don't leave them behind. I think you will agree that they deserve to be mourned. If you are able, save for them a place inside of you, and save one backward glance when you are leaving for the places they can no longer go. Be not ashamed to say you love them, though you may or may not have always. Take what they have taught you with their dying, and keep it with your own. And in that time when men decide and feel safe to call the war insane, take one moment to embrace those gentle heroes you left behind. Major Michael O'Donnell, killed in action, March 24, 1970, Dak To, Vietnam. Warriors weep at funerals, but not at the memory of battle. "There is something gone wrong, my brave boy, it appears, for I see your proud struggle to keep back the tears." That is right. When you cannot give trouble the slip, then bear it, still keeping a stiff upper lip. Though you cannot escape disappointment and care, the next best thing to do is to learn how to bear. If when for life's prizes you're running, you trip, get up, start again, keep a stiff upper lip. Through childhood, through manhood, through life to the end, struggle bravely and stand by your colors, my friend. Only yield when you must, never give up the ship, but fight on to the last with a stiff upper lip. Keep a stiff upper lip. Phoebe Carey, 1824 to 1871. Rules of Behavior After Combat. The second rule of behavior after combat is that it is not okay to weep at the memory of battle. A warrior who does is like a firefighter who weeps at the memory of fire, or a pilot who weeps at the memory of flight. The firefighter and the pilot can mourn comrades killed in fires and crashes, but still find satisfaction in what they do. Combat is what warriors do, and if the memory of battle is unbearably painful to them, then they will have great difficulty doing it again. Like the widow of 50 years mentioned earlier, the veteran must come to terms with what has happened, and he must delink the memory from the emotions. We have always conducted critical incident debriefings. We did them every night around the campfire, and the old sarge always led them. There was always an old sarge, an old captain, or an old chief who was the survivor of past battles. We knew that if we were going to be survivors, if we were going to be there for our village or our nation in the years to come, then we had to be like him. Old Sarge modeled survivor behavior, and Old Sarge was calm. Across untold thousands of years, we learned that the man who became weepy or angry when he talked about his combat experience would not be there for his village next year. unless he was able to get his emotions under control. Other than in funerals, warriors have always been embarrassed to weep in front of their brothers, and they were embarrassed to see a brother weep because it showed a character flaw, a true weakness, which meant that he might fail his comrades in the future if he was not able to get his emotions under control. The laconic Spartans modeled this behavior. The inscrutable samurai epitomized this code. The quiet plainsman, woodsman, and cowboy, who were products of the American Civil War, the Indian Wars, and the harsh frontier, symbolized this ethic. And the sang-froid, the savoir-faire that marked the height of the French Empire, or the ethic of the British imperturbability, the stiff upper lip that sustained the British Empire. These things were more than just affectations. They were vital survival skills. The Stoic Romans exemplified this ethos, but today, almost 2,000 years later, they have evolved into the wonderful, colorful, flamboyant, emotional, and militarily incompetent Italians. Homer talked of this falling off of martial skills, this military fall from grace, over 2,500 years ago in the Iliad. Chiefs who no more in bloody fights engage, but wise through time and narrative with age. In summer days like grasshoppers rejoice, a bloodless race that send a feeble voice. Like leaves on trees the race of man is found, now green in youth, now withering on the ground. Another race the following spring supplies, they fall successive and successive rise. Perhaps the secret to long-term survival as a civilization is to develop and nurture a group of stoic, laconic, stiff upper lip warriors. Always the standard has been there for us, set by the old Sarge, because only someone like him would survive across the years. Perhaps now we can understand, when we observe such behavior, that it is not some mindless macho affectation, but a vital warrior survival skill. One classic example can be seen in the real-life character of Sergeant Major Plumley in the movie We Were Soldiers. That movie was drawn from the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young, written by the battalion commander and the journalist who were there in America's first major battle in Vietnam. The movie is about the experiences of the real warriors who fought in that battle, and it is one of the most accurate depictions of the behavior of men in combat that you will ever see. Sergeant Major Plumley, played by Sam Elliott in the movie, was a veteran of combat in World War II and Korea. So when it came time for him to engage in combat in Vietnam, how did he behave? He was calm. The definition of courage is grace under pressure. We have always honored the ability of a warrior to control his emotions and demonstrate grace under pressure. Do you think Private Plumley was like that in his first battle? No. It took many battles and years of combat experience for him to grow into that warrior. And there could be no doubt that there was an old Sarge who modeled that behavior and taught him to remain calm in the heat of battle. Nietzsche said, "What does not kill me only makes me stronger." But this concept was communicated long before Nietzsche, almost 2,000 years ago when it was written, "We glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation worketh patience, and patience experience, and experience hope, and hope maketh not ashamed." Romans chapter 5, verse 3 through 5. The young warrior fails and picks himself up, dusts himself off, and drives on, year after year, to become the veteran that others can depend on in their hour of need. And always the lesson he learns is to remain calm, to have grace under pressure. So you see, the debriefing is not some kumbaya sob fest. We can weep at funerals, but we strive not to weep at the memory of battle. The tool that we use to control our emotions, to keep the puppy from coming through the screen door, is the tactical breathing exercise, which will be covered in the next chapter. For now, understand that the goal is to maintain control of your emotions and remain calm before, during, and after combat. This does not mean that the warrior knows no joy. The process of multiplying the joy includes finding humor and laughter in your memories, often with an earthy, even body humor. Controlling your emotions does not mean you have no emotions. there can be a deep and abiding joy in the warrior's life, as long as he keeps the puppy under control. As Shakespeare wrote, "Give me that man that is not passion's slave, and I will wear him in my heart's core, aye, in my heart of heart." Hamlet. For centuries, we divided the pain and multiplied the joy, striving not to be passion's slave, and learning, always learning from the old Sarge, how to survive in this toxic realm of combat. The 20th century. Farewell to tranquil mind. Farewell the tranquil mind, farewell content. Farewell the plumed troop and the big wars that make ambition virtue. Oh, farewell. Farewell the neighing steed and the shrill trump, the spirit-stirring drum, the ear-piercing fife, the royal banner and all quality, pride, pomp, and circumstance of glorious war. Shakespeare, Othello. The 20th century has seen a farewell to tranquil mind for the warrior. Not only have there been horrendous, brutal wars unlike anything before in history, but the combatant has also been increasingly denied whatever small solace there was to be found in the sad, wretched duty that his nation sent him to perform. As Winston Churchill said, "War, which was cruel and glorious, has become cruel and sordid." The era of debriefing around a nighttime campfire ended with the beginning of World War I. The profoundly different nature of combat in World War I is superbly captured in John Keegan's classic book, The Face of Battle, which I highly recommend as a primer for understanding this dramatic change. Suddenly, warriors could no longer take the nights off, because combat was now taking place day and night for months on end. There was no escape from the danger, so the warriors did not get a chance to make peace with the memory every night. In his book, A History of Warfare, John Keegan notes how this debriefing process changed during the 20th century. There was a debriefing of a sort after the battle in World War I, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, but it was often after weeks and months of continuous combat, rather than on a daily basis. There was also a form of debriefing when the troops sailed home, which had great value, but this did not occur in Vietnam, when the soldiers flew home as individuals after their tour of duty was finished. Throughout history, the veteran has learned to make peace with his memory. Often they even made friends with their memory. Stephen Pressfield speaks of this in his book, The Gates of Fire. "I have heard it said that for the lover, the seasons are marked in memory by those mistresses whose beauty has inflamed his heart. He recalls this year as the one when, moonstruck, he pursued a certain beloved about the city, and that year when another favorite yielded at last to his charms. For the mother and father, on the other hand, the seasons are numbered by the births of their children. This one's first step, that one's initial word. By these homely ticks is the calendar of the loving parent's life demarcated and set within the book of remembrance." Before the warrior, the seasons are marked not by these sweet measures, nor by the calendar years themselves, but by battles. Campaigns fought and comrades lost, trials of death survived, clashes and conflicts from which time effaces all superficial recall, leaving only the fields themselves and their names, which achieve in the warrior's memory a stature ennobled beyond all other modes of commemoration, purchased with the holy coin of blood, and paid for with the lives of beloved brothers in arms. As the priest with his graphis and tablet of wax, the infantryman too has inscription. His history is carved upon his person with the stylus of steel, his alphabet engraved with spear and sword indelibly upon the flesh. The Civil War veterans were no different than all those who had gone before. They too had ennobled the memory of their battles. They came home and told war stories. They bounced their grandbabies on their knees and proudly told of shooting Johnny Reb or killing the damned Yankees. They wrote their memoirs by the thousands in intimate detail. The returning World War I veteran was different. The returning veteran of this war did not talk about his experiences. He didn't make peace with his memories immediately after the battle. Later, they were too painful to touch, so we tried to not think about them. He tried to bury his memories, but sometimes they were buried alive. Many veterans of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam did the same thing. Throughout the 20s,